and empty. They also visited a place the historian had found called Fort Knox, but it was just a gutted ruin. Dunnell Dean had accumulated a remarkable fund of information and picto-recorder shots. Bridges gone, tumbled rubble, wild game, wild cattle, and varmints abundant, no trace of people, and they had had some hair-raising experiences. But they got no gold. They had come to the conclusion that the cyclos, as much as 1,000 years ago, had thoroughly gutted this planet of gold. They must have even taken it from corpses in the streets, rings from fingers and fillings from teeth. Possibly this, along with the cyclosport of hunting humans on days off, accounted for the thoroughness of population wipeout. There was evidence that in the early days of conquest, they had even massacred people just for their rings and fillings. They began to understand Turl a little better in his dangerous enterprise to possess the yellow metal for himself. To the humans, the metal meant very little. They had no experience of using it in trade. It was pretty and didn't tarnish, and was easily pounded into shape, but stainless steel had a lot more utility. Their own ideas of trade and thrift had to do with useful items that were real wealth. None of this got them any closer to getting a ton of gold. They frantically test-drilled for the lost vein. On day 70, they found the vein again. It had been shifted by some past upheaval 231 feet to the north and only 30 feet from the surface. They wiped off their sweating faces, the droplets tending to freeze in the bitter winter winds of these altitudes, made a new level area for equipment and a new shaft, and began to drift again along the white quartz. The vein had thinned down to about 3 feet in width. They drove on, filling the dark air of the drift with white chips and blast fumes. Johnny went back to studying the battle reports. They must know cyclo tactics very precisely. He was once again struck with the oddity of this attack on a tank in Denver, where no tank existed. He narrowed down the location on the faded satellite photos. They had kept coming off the machine even after the president was dead. Yes, there was smoke at that place. They had scouted out Denver thoroughly. Typically, Turl had not intended to work in the U.S. Mint to refine his gold. He had set up a place in the basement of the remains of a smelter a few minutes' drive away. He was just using the U.S. Mint as a receipt point. But all the gold invoices they found in the mines said U.S. Mint, and it seemed to Johnny that where so much gold was funneled in, there might be further traces there in case they missed at the load. Also, this tank that didn't exist to the U.S. military might have been guarding the mint. In a swift foray, he and Dunnell Dean swooped down to the U.S. Mint. They had made very sure there were no ground cars or planes as the afternoon faded. They landed in a park in the cover of giant trees and sped on silent feet to the mint. The place was still. It had been scouted before, but once more they went over it just in case the cyclos had missed a vault. Inside they found nothing. They lingered outside in the darkness. Dunnell Dean amused himself by prying into the mounds that had once been cars, wondering what they looked like in the days when they could run. Johnny was thinking about the views Turl had shown him. He went around to the back and played a mine lamp on the ground so it would reflect a dim light up. Shortly, he was looking at the largest mound. It came to him that this must be the tank the battle plane had destroyed, the non-existent tank. He lifted some turf. Brown sand and grass had overlaid it. He cut the turf very carefully so it could be laid back and leave no sign of disturbance. This thing wasn't an ordinary car. It was so thickly built that it had endured the rust of time. The metal was twisted where it had burned out. He had never seen anything like this. It had a slot one might fire out of, but that would be its closest resemblance to a tank. The window frames had bars over them, a bit like a cage. What was this thing? He pried a section of metal aside with a mine crowbar and got inside. The interior had been blackened by fire, and floor plates had warped. He pried up a floor plate. Half a minute later, a smiling Johnny was making a bird call and beckoning for Donald Dean. He took the Scott inside. As one might piece together, when the cyclo attack came, the U.S. Mint had sought to evacuate its vaults. Gold. How much? In extremely heavy ingots, there it had lain neatly for 1,000 years. Overlooked, for everyone thought it was a tank. They estimated its weight with excited heftings, and then their excitement dimmed. "That's less than a tenth of a ton," said Donald Dean. "Would Turtle be satisfied with that?" Johnny didn't think so. In fact, he knew Turtle wouldn't. It was also far less than suited their own project.
"A tenth of a loaf is better than none," said Donald Dean.
They packed the 200 pounds of gold in the plane and put the tank back together and scattered snow on it and around it to cover tracks. They now had about 300 pounds in gold. They needed a ton. It was enough to make one take up alchemy, the mythical conversion of lead to gold, said the historian when they returned. And in fact, he spent hours that night fruitlessly studying just that. The parson made a visit to Johnny's village to prepare the people for the possibility of withdrawal into the old base. He told Johnny his Aunt Ellen sent her love, and for him to be very careful in the wild places he went. Johnny detected the parson was sweet on Aunt Ellen, and privately wished him luck. They felt bad they couldn't warn other peoples on this planet. If they failed, man might indeed become extinct. 8. The shift that went on duty at the end of Day 86 began like any other shift. The vein had been narrowing lately, pinching out. They tried not to be hopeful, but shift ends, when they had not found the pocket yet, were always a bitter disappointment. Donald Dean, recovered from the cave-in, was operating a chattering spade bit, sweat streaming off him in the closed, hot confines of the drift. He had a sudden illusion that a drop of sweat had turned color as it dropped into his eye. He switched off the spade bit to clear his vision. He looked again in front of him through the swirling smoke and white dust. The illusion was still there, but it wasn't an illusion. A single round spot of yellowing gold marked the shining white vein. He put the spade bit against it and turned it on. The chattering edge bit further. He shut it off and walked closer to the vein. He stood stock still and then let out a blasting whistle to stop the shift. He pointed, and then bedlam broke loose. It was gold. They had finally hit the second pocket. The shift abruptly left off shouting, and every bit and drill they had down there began to cut into the vein. The wire gold began to blossom against the white. An excited call went to the duty watch in town, and in a handful of minutes, they had the third shift helping them. The town went wild. Every Scot and even two of the old widows helped form a human bucket line out of the mine, weighing, sacking, and loading bag after bag of mixed wire gold and quartz. To the devil with the odd bits of rock. The gold was like twisted springs and small cages of gleaming yellow. Before sunset on Day 88, they had the whole pocket out. 1,647 pounds it weighed out, subtracting the rock. Adding to that the 306 pounds they already had, it made 1,953 pounds. It was short of a ton, but it would have to do. The project was on its way. They began to oil their assault rifles. The parson prayed long and earnestly for their success. There were no parallels for odds such as these. 9. Turl waited, trying to be casual, in front of the U.S. Mint. It was 2 hours after sunset on Day 89. It was good and dark. There would be no moon these next 3 nights. The weather on this cursed planet was on the edge of spring. There had already been a warm day or two. All the snow was gone. It was reasonably warm tonight, and he had been prepared to wait. Animals were pretty stupid about time. He was leaning against a flatbed truck he had driven in from the base. It was a shabby relic, not even on the inventory. It wouldn't be missed. He had prepared it carefully. But right on time, there were the animals. With only a pinpoint of light pointed at the ground, their vehicle rolled up and stopped a few feet from Turl. It was heavily laden. So they had kept their part of the bargain after all. Yes, animals certainly were stupid. There were three man-things in the cab, but Turl couldn't restrain his eagerness. He walked over to the flatbed and began to poke talons and a light into the sacks. Wire gold. Unrefined. Unmelted. A bit of the white quartz clinging. No, here were some melted chunks. He remembered himself and stood back and played a radiation detector on the sacks. Clean. He estimated the load by a practiced glance at the pistons that supported the body over the driving mechanism. Allowing for the slight weight of the man-things, maybe 400 pounds, and for the debris, he must have about 1,900 pounds here. Recent trade papers told him that gold, in its scarcity at home, had soared to 8,321 galactic credits an ounce. This load was worth about... he was very good at figures in his head... about 189,718,800 credits. Several dozen fortunes. Wealth and power. He felt very expansive. The animals hadn't gotten out of the cab. Turl went to the side of it and flashed a subdued light into it. These fellows all had black beards. Actually, it was Dunnell Dean, Dwight, and another Scott. Turl went through a pantomime seeking to ask where the animal Johnny was. The pantomime might or might not have been comprehensible, but Dwight, who spoke Cyclo, knew exactly what was meant. Purposely speaking in broken Cyclo, Dwight said, "Johnny not can come. Him have accident. Him hurt foot. He say we come. Much apology." Turl was a bit taken aback by the information. It upset his planning. But yes, in the recon drone pictures this afternoon, he had noticed an overturned blade scraper at the site, and had seen no sign of the blonde-bearded Johnny who for months had always been visible. Well, no matter. It didn't upset much. It just delayed getting rid of the females. A hurt foot wouldn't stop that animal's psychic powers if he touched the females ahead of time. And if aroused, they could cause mischief. No mischief that he, Turl, couldn't handle.
"We help transfer sacks to other truck," said Dwight.
Turl had never intended that. "No," he said, making wide, explicit motions, rather hard to see in the dark. "We just swap trucks. You get it? I keep your truck, you take this truck." The three Scots piled out of the huge cab of the Cyclo truck they had brought and got into Turl's. Dunnell Dean took the controls. He started the motors and made a wide sweep in the street, turning back the way they had come. Turl stood with a waiting smile upon his mouth bones. The truck went up to the corner and turned into a side street, out of sight of Turl. Dunnell Dean hastily punched in the numbers to keep it going down the slope. He looked sideways to make sure Dwight and the other Scott had the door open.
"Go!" he barked.
The other two dove out the door. Dunnell Dean shot his own door open and in a rolled ball hit the soft turf of the street. He glanced back. The other two were up and running for cover, a pair of darker blurs in the dark. He yanked a heat detector shield out of his belt and began to run to an alley. He made it. The flatbed went on down the street for another 100 yards. It exploded with a battering, violent concussion that blew in the buildings on both sides of the street. Back at the gold-laden flatbed, Turl chuckled. He could hear the patter of pieces beginning to hit as they returned to Earth for blocks around. There was a roaring sigh as some buildings collapsed. He was pleased. He would have been more pleased if the animal had been in it. He didn't have to go and look. He wouldn't have found anything anyway. The distance-fused demolition charge had been placed under the cab seats. Turl got in the laden truck and drove to the smelter he had rigged. He had done number 5 of 7 alternate possible actions in booby-trapping and sending the truck back. It had been dicey, pre-calculating the options. The teams in anti-heat capes drew back from the surrounding buildings. They collected Donald Dean and the other two and went off for stage two. Would they be this fortunate next time? Dicey indeed, outguessing a mad cyclo. 10. The workroom in the ancient smelter had been all set up by Turl. The windows had been shuttered and the doors made snug. The only piece of equipment of the original man setup that he was using was the huge metal cauldron in the middle of the floor, and this, too, he had reworked, surrounding it with cyclo-speed heaters. Tools, molds, and molecular sprays were all laid out. The marking equipment was that of the morgue down at the compound. Turl parked the flatbed in front of the unlighted door, and with practically no effort at all, carried in ore sacks, 6 or 8 at a time, and emptied them into the cauldron. He hid the flatbed, came in and barred the door, and checked to see that all the shutters were in place. He did not notice a newly drilled hole in one. He turned on the portable lights. With practiced ease, he darted the point of a probe around the interior to make sure there were no bugs or button cameras. Satisfied, he laid the equipment aside. The instant it clattered to the bench, an unseen hand unfastened an ancient ventilator door and placed 2 button cameras in advantageous positions. The ventilator door, well oiled, was shut again. A bit of dust, dislodged in the action, drifted down across a lamp beam. Turl looked up. Rats, he thought. Always rats in these buildings. He turned on the speed heaters of the cauldron, and the wire gold and lumps began to settle down and shrink. Bubbles began to form. One had to be careful not to overheat gold. It went into gaseous form, and much could be lost in vapors. The roof beams of this old smelter must be saturated in gold gas that had recondensed. He watched the thermometers carefully. The yellow-orange content of the cauldron went liquid, and he turned the heaters to maintain. The molds were all laid out. They were for coffin lids ordinarily used in manufacture, for coffins were a local product, made in the shops of the compound. Turl had a huge ladle in mittened paws and began to transfer liquid gold into the first lid mold. 200 pounds of gold per coffin, 10 coffin lids. He worked fast and expertly, taking care to spill none. The hiss of the molten metal striking the molds was pleasant to his earbones. How easy all this was! The company insisted on lead coffins. Now and then an employee died in a radiation accident on some far planet, and after some messy experiences, such as coffins falling apart in transshipment or creating minor accidents with radiation, the company, 50 or 60,000 years ago, had laid down exact rules. Lead was a glut on the market on Cyclo. They had lots of that. They also had plenty of iron and copper and chrome. What were scarce were gold, bauxite, molybdenum, and several other metals. And what was absent, thank the evil gods, was uranium and all its family of ores. So the coffins were always made of lead, stiffened up with an alloy or two, such as bismuth. He only had to make lids. There were stacks and stacks of coffins in the morgue. One of the reasons he had to be secretive was that it would look a bit silly for him to be making more coffins and bringing them in. Presently, he had 9 lid molds filled. It was a bit tricky on the 10th. The cauldron was down to the bottom, and a residue of rock was mixed in the dregs. He had to be speedy with all this, for it had to be done before dawn. He speed-chilled the dregs and dumped in a demijohn of acid to dissolve the rock and sediment left. Then he speed-warmed it again. The clouds of boiling acid looked good to him. He was in a breathe mask, so who cared? He spooned the dissolved dregs out and reheated the gold. By scraping very carefully, he was able to get the last lid fairly full. He made up the weight with a bit of melted lead. While the lid molds cooled, he cleaned up the cauldron and ladle and made sure there were no splatters on the floor. The lids weren't cooling fast enough, and he put a portable fan to them. He gingerly tapped one. Good. With care, he tapped the lids out of the molds and laid them on a bench. He got out a molecular spray and fed a lead bismuth rod into it, and began to paint the gold with a lead bismuth covering. About 7 lead bismuth rods later, he had 10 lead-like coffin lids. He took off his mittens and gathered up the marking equipment that usually stayed in the morgue. He pulled a list from his pocket. With great neatness, he marked 10 names, company worker serial numbers, and dates of death on the lids. It had taken some trouble getting 10 bodies. There were the 3 sentries blown up by the exploding gun. There was Numpf. There was Jayed. Blast him. But a mine safety program being run over in medical had kept casualties down from normal, and there had been only 3 mine deaths since the last semi-annual firing. This left Turl 2 bodies short. One he had acquired by casually dropping a blasting cap into a shot hole before they tamped in the explosive. He had thought to get 2 or 3 with this, but he only got the explosives expert. The other one had been rather involved. He had loosened the steering bar of a tri-wheeler. The things were quite high speed and ran around lots of obstacles. But he had had to wait 3 boring days until it finally spilled and killed the admin personnel riding it. So he had his 10 names. He punched them into the soft metal of the lids with the marker. He inspected them. 2 showed gold through, and that would not do. He got out his molecular spray and sprayed lead bismuth over them. Fine. He made a test with a claw point. The covering didn't scratch. It would probably also stand up to the handling of fork trucks. He then took a marker and made a small X, hard to see unless you looked for it, on the lower left-hand corner of each lid. Time was getting on. He rapidly scooped up his equipment and disengaged the speed heater from the cauldron. He looked around. He had everything. He turned out the lights, pulled the truck in front of the door, and loaded 2 or 3 lids at a time. He dumped the equipment on it. He went back in, took a bag of dust and scattered it around the room, flashed his lamp about 1 more time to make sure, closed the doors, and happily drove off. In the smelter, the ventilator opened and the button cameras were retrieved with a quick hand. The hole in the shutter was repaired. Turl drove rapidly to the compound. It was now very late, but he had, as of recent weeks, made a practice of driving about the compound as though doing rounds, and the sound of the motor would alert no one. It was very dark. He stopped at the morgue. Without lights, he carried the 10 lids inside. Then he drove the truck to the nearby scrap dump and dug the equipment into and under another pile of scrap. He walked back to the morgue, closed the door, and turned on the lights. He probed the place for bugs. He did not notice a small hole drilled through the thick wall or the button camera that appeared there right after his probe. Turl lined up 10 coffins from the stacks of empties. He took off their lids and dumped them back of the stack. He moved the 10 around so they would be in position to be picked up by the forklifts on day 92. From the shelves, he yanked down the 10 bodies and dumped them with thuds into the coffins. Jayed's was the last one.
Jayed, you silly crunch. What a crap-lousy IBI agent you were. It ain't smart, Jayed, to come in here worrying your betters. And what did you get for it?
Turl picked up the lid he'd made, checked the name.
A coffin and a grave burying you under the phony name of Snit.
The glazed eyes seemed to regard him reproachfully.
No, Jayed, said Turl. It will do no good to argue, none at all. Neither your murder nor that of Numpf will ever be traced to me. Goodbye, Jayed.
He slammed the coffin lid down on Jayed. He covered the rest of the coffins with his lids. He checked the small X's. He took a tool that cold bonded metal and sealed the lids down to the coffins. He put the tool on the shelf. He took the name-marking tool out of his pocket and put it where it belonged. He looked around and stood straighter. So far, all was perfect. And he was already a whole day early for the semi-annual firing. He reached for the light. He did not hear the whisper against stone as the button camera was withdrawn from the hole, or the squish of cement as the hole was blocked. Turl opened the door. It was getting dimly light. He walked across the open space, the firing platform, and up the hill to his quarters. Behind him at the morgue, two caped figures slipped away into the ravine. 4 hours later, on this day 91, Johnny, Robert the Fox, the council, and team members concerned went over and over the picto recorder pictures. They must not miss the tiniest possibility or the largest option. They could not afford to miss. The fate, not just of themselves, but of galaxies, depended upon making no mistakes. Chapter 12. 1. The recreation hall of the compound was ablaze with light and bursting with noise. It was jammed full of cyclos, and they were mostly drunk. It was a grand party on the evening of the semi-annual firing. Char and two other executives were going home. It was something to celebrate, the end of a duty tour on this accursed planet. Attendants rushed about with saucepans of Kerbango, held 6 or 8 at a time in their paws. Female cyclo clerks, released from the cowed decorum that was their normal lot, joked and got their bottoms smacked. A couple of fights had already started and ended without anyone discovering what the fight had been about. Games of chance and marksmanship were a tangle of disorganized confusion. Jokes of a bawdy and discreditable nature were being buffeted at the departing executives.
Have a saucepan on me at the Claw in Imperial City. Don't buy more wives than you can handle in one night.
Tell them a thing or two at the home office about what it's like out here, the mangy slobs.
The atmosphere was so convivial that even care was included, and the midget sat with pompous importance trying to judge a contest of how many bites a minute could be taken from a saucepan with the participant's paws held behind him. 5 executives were chanting a school yell that went, "Cyclo, cyclo, cyclo, kill 'em, kill 'em, kill 'em," over and over, tunelessly but loud. Down back of the firing platform, a train of pack horses, hoofs muffled with furred hide, moved silently out of a ravine and through the dark toward the unlit morgue. The greenish compound glow reached toward them unrevealingly. A faint clink of metal as Angus McTavish unlocked the morgue door with a master key. Char was very drunk, drunk and reeling. He walked unsteadily over to Turl, who looked drunk but was cold and tensely sober.
"That's a good idea," said Char.
He was always a nasty drunk, and the more he drank, the nastier he got.
"What is?"
said Turl through the uproar.
"Tell him a thing or two at the home office," hiccuped Char.
Turl went very still. Char did not see his eyes narrow and flame. Then Turl said in a drunken slur,
"I got a little present for you, Char. Come outside for a minute."
Char lifted his eyebones.
"Ain't got a mask."
"There's masks beside the doorport," said Turl.
Unobserved by the rest, Turl steered him to the hall and they got into masks in a tangled fashion. Turl went through the atmosphere lock, dragging Char behind. Turl led him down near the zoo cages. There was no fire burning. It was too late. There was no bundle in front of the cage. The spring chill of the exterior revived Char a trifle, and he returned to being nasty.
"Animals," he said. "You're a animal lover, Turl. I never did like you, Turl."
Turl was not listening to him. What was that down by the morgue? He peered more closely. There were animals down there.
"You're awful clever, Turl, but you're not clever enough to fool me."
Turl took a couple of steps toward the morgue, trying to see in the dark. He took out a pocket torch and flashed it in that direction.
Brown hide? Hard to see.
Then he got a better view of it. A small herd of buffalo. They'd been drifting north for days now, mixed in with some horses. He turned the torch off. The casually walking hoofs were distant tiny thuds. Louder were the squeaks and crunches of the new spring grass being pulled up as the herd grazed its way along. An owl was hooting off somewhere. Usual nonsense of this accursed planet. He gave his attention back to Char. Churl put his arm around Char's shoulder and guided him back to a point where the circles of the compound domes made a recess as they met. It was very dark here, hidden from all views.
"What didn't fool you, friend Char?"
asked Churl. The owl hooted again. Churl looked around. There were no vantage points from which they could be seen. Char was sneering.
"The blast cap smoke," he said, putting his face mask very close to Turl's.
He reeled and Churl held him up.
"What about it?" said Churl.
"Why, that wasn't no blast gun that went off in old Numph's office. That was a blasting cap. You think an old mine boss like me can't smell the difference between a blast gun and a blast cap?"
Turl's paw was reaching for the small of his own back, under the jacket. He'd been trying to work out a way to furnish a reason for launching the gas drone day after tomorrow. He suddenly had it, and without stirring up any psychic powers either.
"A point in care, that miserable excuse, just hours before? Oh," exclaimed the hostile Char. "You are clever enough for some people, but I see through you, Turl. I see through you."
"Why, what did you think?" said Turl.
"Think? I didn't have time to think. When I get home, I can tell them a thing or two." "You ain't so smart, Turl. Think I don't know one smoke from another? And people will agree with me when I get home."
Turl shoved 10 inches of stainless steel knife into Char's heart. It was the knife Johnny had given Chrissy. He lowered the sagging body to the ground. He took a nearby scrap of discarded tarpaulin and covered it. Turl went back to the cage and looked in. The girls were sleeping. The buffalo herd was still moving quietly past the morgue. Turl went back inside. There was more to do tonight, but just now the party must not realize he had been absent. He joined the cyclos who were chanting. They were very drunk. Down at the morgue, men moved carefully so as not to disturb the buffalo they had drifted in on the place from the plain. The horses were unloaded and gone. Nobody had observed the murder of Char. It was not possible to get that close to the domes without being seen. Those in the morgue continued their work, unaware that a new factor had been entered into planning, one they did not know about and had not predicted. The farewell party continued to racket noise out of the compound, unaware that their guest of honor was missing. 2. Johnny lay in a coffin at the near end of the morgue. The lid was slightly propped open to give him air and an interior view. On the outside roof, a button camera brought the exterior scene to a hand viewer resting beside him in the dark confines. He was dressed in chinko blue, but he wore moccasins, the better to speed him today. For today, in the space of just 2 exact minutes, he had to cover certain exact grounds and do very drilled and exact things, and do them in an exact time, or the whole project would fail, and he would be dead, and Chrissy and Patty would die as well, and all the Scots and others left on Earth. He heard the transshipment area control tower warning horn for the incoming phase.
"Motors off, stand clear."
The humming came on. The ground vibrated. The coffin lid trembled. The humming built up and up. Suddenly, 200 new incoming cyclos appeared on the platform along with their baggage. The humming dropped. A faint vibration remained.
"Coordinates holding and linked up with second stage."
The whole area came to life. 1 hour and 13 minutes would elapse now until they fired back to Cyclo. Personnel department members were herding the incoming draft off to the side and getting them in line. Turl eyed the assemblage. The last time a draft had come in, he had had a bad shock, and now he wasn't taking any chances. He was half expecting to find a new planet head in this lot, somebody to replace Care, and he might have to think fast. He walked down the line, not looking at baggage for contraband. He was just looking at faces through their domed transport helmets, checking off the names. 200. More of old Numph's nonsense to get as many on the swindle payroll as he could. Turl went down the whole line. He breathed a sigh of relief. No replacement here for Care. Just the usual gutter sweepings from the slums of Cyclo, plus an oddball junior executive and a couple of graduates from the mine school. Routine. Not one in the lot that could qualify as a planet head. All a bit lethargic. No agents from IBI either. Turl raised a paw to personnel and they divided some off for waiting transport planes destined for other mine sites, and some to berthing here. They loaded them on flatbeds with their baggage and they were gone. That was a relief to Turl. He approached the morgue. That blasted horse of the animals that was always hanging around the compound was grazing in back of the morgue.
"Get away from here!"
Turl yelled at the horse and made paw motions to shoo him off. The horse looked at Turl indifferently, and when Turl went to open the door, it came even closer. Turl unlocked the morgue door and threw it wide. There were 10 coffins lying there, ready to be scooped up by lift machines. He checked for the small X marks on the covers. Nothing like taking precautions. Every lid had its little X mark. He patted one of them fondly. He took a deep breath. Maybe 8 or 10 months from now, he would be digging these up some dark Cyclo night in the isolated and dreary cemetery on Cyclo. And it would be riches, power. The fruits of his project were hard won. They wouldn't be that hard to spend. The first lift came, thrust its prongs under a coffin. Turl went back outside. He checked off the name on his records. The second coffin, the third, the fourth. Turl looked at the fourth one, a bit puzzled. How come he had spelled Jayed's false name wrong? Not Snit, S-N-I-T, but Stani, S-T-N-I. He checked for the X. That was there, all right. Well, to crap with it. He'd enter the error on the record. One good false name deserved another. The ex-agent was good and dead. That's all that mattered. The lifts were dumping the coffins any which way on the platform. Turl watched, a bit apprehensive at the rough handling. But none landed upside down. 9 of the coffins were lying out there now. The lift superintendent stopped his machine beside Turl to let him check off number 10, the last one he was carrying.
"These coffins seem awful heavy," commented the superintendent.
Turl looked up, masking any alarm. They were only about 100 pounds overweight, not enough to notice and certainly not enough to make much difference to a lift machine. The coffins should weigh about 1,700 each, even with those lids.
"Your power cartridge is probably half discharged," said Turl.
"Maybe," said the superintendent. The coffin seemed like 3,000 pounds, but he rolled the machine and dumped the 10th one on the platform. The personnel department flatbed for outgoing personnel came up. Its driver was looking a little harassed. There were 5 Cyclos and their baggage on the truck, 2 of them returning executives and the other 3 ordinary miners going home. The driver gave Turl the list.
"You'll have to change that list," said the driver. "Char is supposed to be on it. He was scheduled to go home today, and all of us in personnel have been running around looking for him, and we can't find him. His baggage is here, but we can't find Char."
"Which is his baggage?" asked Turl.
The driver pointed to a separate pile, and Turl swept it off the truck with 1 sweep of his arm.
"We looked everywhere," said the driver. "Shouldn't we hold up the firing?" You know we can't do that, said Turl quickly. Did you look in the beds of the female admin people?
The driver let out a guffaw.
I guess we should have done that. That was some party last night. We'll fire him off in 6 months, said Turl, and wrote, "Fires later," on the document after Char's name and signed it.
The personnel flatbed went off to dump the passengers on the platform. They stood about in a group, making sure their firing helmets were on tight. They were several feet away from the coffins. Turl glanced at his watch, 1 hour and 11 minutes. 2 more minutes to go.
Coordinates holding on second stage, came from the bullhorn over the operations dome.
The white light was flashing. Turl walked back closer to the morgue. That blasted horse was poking around the door. Turl made shooing motions with his paws. The horse moved off a few steps and began to graze again. It was a relief to see those coffins out there. Turl stood gazing upon them fondly. About 1 minute to go. Then his hair seemed to stand on end. From within the morgue, the empty, deserted morgue, came a voice. 3. When the last coffin had gone out the open door, Johnny had silently slid out of his coffin. He had 3 kill clubs thrust in his belt, and he was holding a 4th, the heaviest one. He laid a picto recorder player in the middle of the floor with 1 flashing motion and backed up behind the door. The shadow of Turl outside lay across the floor. The recorder started to play. It was a recording of Turl's own voice. It said,
"J-Ed, you silly crunch. What a crap lousy IBI agent you were."
It was playing loudly enough to be heard outside. The shadow of Turl contracted, turning. The recorder said,
"It ain't smart, J-Ed, to come in here worrying your betters."
Turl lunged through the door, slamming it shut with a frantic hand. He raised his boot to stamp the recorder into oblivion. Johnny dove forward. With a motion he had drilled and drilled with a dummy, the kill club crashed into Turl's skull. With his other hand, even as Turl fell forward, Johnny ripped up the pocket flap and got the remote control box to the cage. A horn was going outside.
"Coordinates holding on first stage, motors off."
Johnny hit Turl again. The body collapsed. Johnny ripped the breathe mask off Turl's face and threw it clear to the far end of the morgue, where it landed with a clatter. He bent over Turl. Green blood was running down the side of the monster's head. The feet were drumming. Then Turl was still. There was no breathing. The eyes seemed glazed. He would have liked to put a shot in Turl. He took the belt gun. But he didn't dare shoot. Until those wires out there started to hum, they could stop the firing. The instant the wires began to hum, he knew the process was irreversible. The bullhorn bawled, "Stand clear." The wires had begun to hum. Johnny's 2 minutes had begun, and they might well be his last 2 minutes alive. He had clicked on the stopwatch on his wrist. He flashed out the door and twisted the lock closed behind him. In these 2 minutes, nobody would fire a gun since it might hit wires or mess up coordinate settings. He took in the scene. Windsplitter was only 3 paces away from where he was supposed to be. Johnny was on him, and with 1 heel jab, they were running. In a flying blur, they raced to the platform. The humming was intensifying. Anything that stayed on that platform was going to go to Cyclo, where you couldn't even breathe the atmosphere. And a very messy arrival this would be if all went well. Windsplitter's hoofs hit the metal of the platform, and he reared to a stop as Johnny dove for the first coffin. His fingers sought a little round ring that imperceptibly stood out just under the lid at the top end. He pulled it, and a strip came away in his hand. 1. Second coffin, ring found, pull, strip in hand. 2. The third coffin, ring, strip. 3. A hysterical Cyclo voice came on the bullhorn.
"Clear the platform! Clear the platform!"
The small group of Cyclos beyond the coffins woke up to something strange going on. They stared. One of the executives, hungover from the party, raised his arm to point. Fourth, fifth, and sixth rings. In these coffins were 10 Planet Buster nuclear missile bombs, forbidden by treaties because they could crack the planet's crust and spray the world with fallout. Packed around them were the dirtiest early radioactive atomic bombs, outlawed because of their extreme pollution potential. The seventh ring was bent. Johnny fumbled with it.
"Grab him!" screamed the executive on the platform.
The 5 cyclos moved to attack. Johnny threw his kill club at the executive. He went down. Johnny yanked 2 more kill clubs from his belt and hurled them in a blur of speed. 2 more cyclos went down. He got back to number 7. He untwisted it and got it out. He grabbed number 8 and pulled it. There was a suicide squad of Scots in the bushes, standing by in case at the last moment Johnny failed. He had forbidden it, but they insisted. He had timed the run. He wanted no dead Scots. Johnny had refused to simply let the fuses be set. If the firing had been canceled, they would have blown Earth out of existence. They had to be sure the irreversible action of actual firing was in progress before these fuse strips were pulled. 9 strips in hand. The 2 remaining cyclos had been further away, but they were coming now. "Strike!" shouted Johnny at Windsplitter. The horse reared and struck the nearest cyclo. The last monster on the platform reached to grab Johnny. 10. Johnny struck with the kill club and smashed the cyclo's helmet. The reaching talons tore his sleeve. He struck again. He leaped to the back of Windsplitter. "Run!" Someone on the control porch had come out with a blast rifle, but did not dare shoot. The humming wires were building up to a crescendo. Johnny was off the platform and racing up the hill to the cage. His watch said 42 seconds left to go. He had never known time to flow so slowly or so fast. He had not gone to Cyclo. But blast rifles were waiting to cut him down. He had already switched the remote control box he had recovered so as to shut off the current to the bars. He had gotten out the metal severing tool so he could slash off the girl's collars. Windsplitter plunged to a halt before the cage door. Johnny threw himself off the horse. He paused for an instant. The cage door was open. The wood barrier was torn aside. Where were the girls? Their effects were all here. Not up. There was a mound under the robes. Ah, they must still be asleep. He rushed in, metal tool ready to cut the collars, shouting their names. No motions in the robes. He threw the furs aside. He was staring at the corpse of Char. It lay on its back, and the stainless steel knife he had given Chrissy was sticking out of Char's middle. He had no time for speculation. He was out of the cage, staring about. Old Pork and Dancer were not there. Could it be possible the girls had actually killed Char and escaped? Not likely. Not with this remote box in Turl's possession. Seconds were ticking away. Blast rifles were waiting. He leaped on Windsplitter and dashed for the edge of the bluff. They started a small avalanche as they halted halfway down the slope. Johnny sprang off and made sure they were covered from sight. The humming came to top crescendo. The strange quiver was in the air. He recognized the feeling. The shipment had shimmered and vanished from the platform. 4. Now would come the usual minor recoil that followed semi-annual firing. Johnny counted the seconds. He was panting heavily from his sprint. Windsplitter beside him was blowing, trembling. Suddenly the ground shook. The air was rent with a splintering crash. A flash lit the sky. Recoil sounded more like the place had blown up. Johnny scrambled to the top of the cliff and peered over the edge. Too much recoil. By fuse, the nuclear weapons should not have gone off on Cyclo for another 10 seconds. The operations dome was still in the air, flames geysering from it. The network of wires around the platform was melting. Machines in the area were sent skidding. Cyclo operators were tumbled to the earth. Wild, aura-like sheet lightning bloomed over the transshipment scene. The compound domes were rocked but seemed intact. The concussion was racketing across the plains. It was too soon for the bombs to go off on Cyclo. What had happened? Had they missed their target and landed their lethal cargo on some nearer space? Did this mean Cyclo armament from the home planet could still appear in the sky and crush them? But right now, the question was, had this messed up their assault plans? He looked anxiously toward the row of battle planes. The instant after recoil was their cue. He looked toward the nearby ravines. Scott teams in camouflage radiation dress were due to sprint out of cover and take possession with their weapons. That recoil might also be radioactive, and here he was with no radiation battle suit. Yay, there went the battle planes. 16 of them had been manned, each with a pilot and co-pilot. They had hidden in the planes all night. Keys to them had been placed on each seat. Up soared the battle planes, a blasting combined roar of heavy motors, 32 Scott pilots and co-pilots. 15 planes peeled off and darted at hypersonic toward their destinations, one plane for each distant mine site on the planet. The mission was to batter and destroy them and prevent a counterattack here. One plane to act as air cover for this central mine site. Radio silence was the watchword. No warning. Johnny looked at the remaining planes on the ground to see whether they had been battered. He noted they were a bit turned. They seemed all right. Wait, something was wrong. There should be 4 planes left there. They only had 32 pilots and co-pilots. But there were 3 planes left, not 4. He raised himself above the cliff edge again and swept the scene. And there it was. The whole side wall of the morgue had been battered out, and the coffin with which it had been done lay in the rubble. Turl had somehow come to life and hammered his way out of the morgue. Johnny looked up. Where there should have been 1 battle plane up there for this mine site, there were 2. Johnny grabbed for wind splitter. Something was wrong. The horse had gone lame in its plunge down the cliff. It was 300 yards to those planes. With a glare at the sky, Johnny was running down the hill, putting all his strength into it. A blast rifle spat at him from the compound. He raced on through a cloud of dirt. Where were the assault teams? Had they been knocked flat? Racing, Johnny headed for the nearest battle plane, shots streaking the air about him. More blast rifles were firing from the compound. He got to the plane door and got it half open. A blast rifle shot slammed it shut. He dove under the plane and went in the other door. The key. The key! Where had Angus put this plane's key? He was scrambling through the edges of the seats. The recoil jolt had jarred the key off the seat. A blast rifle splattered a shot onto the windscreen. There was the key, on the floor. The instant before he touched the starters, he heard the chunk of a bazooka go. Then the flailing chatter of assault rifles. The motors barked, and he raced his hands over the console. The plane flashed upward to 2,000 feet. He caught a glimpse of the attack groups moving in. 2 bazooka teams, 4 assault rifle parties. They had been protected in the ravines in which they had crouched all night, covered with anti-heat shields. Johnny flipped on the view screens. Where was Turl? 5. A few miles to the north, Turl and the mine-site cover plane were engaged in a dance of battle. Johnny slammed his battle plane toward the 2 ships. Suddenly, they moved farther apart. One plane was running away to the north. The other took off in pursuit. 2 Scots running away? No. Johnny suddenly understood what was happening. It was a trick. Turl was pretending to run away to lure the Scots into a trap maneuver. Radio silence. Damn, radio silence. The Scots fell for it. Before Johnny could get there, Turl had looped back and deadly fingers of flame were raking the Scots ship. The target flamed. It roared toward the ground. 2 men ejected, right and left, from the burning plane. Their jetpacks smoked as they bit and arrested their falls. They were sailing some distance apart. If Johnny could get behind Turl while he was still concentrating on the plane, yes. Turl dove to shoot one of the pilots, unable to resist a sadistic touch. The pilot was hit and spun back upward. Johnny was right behind Turl. He pressed his gun trips and the artillery blasters knifed into the ship. Then, abruptly, Turl's plane was gone. A quick glance at the view screens. Turl was above him, but Turl didn't shoot. Abruptly, Johnny realized that Turl was going to ignore him and try to get back to the compound and shoot up the ground troops. The keynote of Cyclo battle tactics was outguessing with a plane's keyboard. The planes could dart so quickly and at such changing speeds that one had to divine what the other would do and do it first. Johnny snapped his battle plane in front of Turl's. For an instant, he could see the face-masked Cyclo through the armored windscreen. It was Turl. A madly efficient Turl. A Turl who, for all his insanity, was a past master at flying and a top marksman. Johnny wondered whether he could match this maniac. Turl went to the right. Johnny had outguessed him and gone the same direction. Turl went farther right. Johnny had outguessed him and was in front of him with ready-firing guns. Turl went up. Johnny's hands on the keyboard did not outguess him, and Turl was almost able to dart past and return to rake the compound assault teams. Johnny corrected and almost rammed Turl from below. Why hadn't he battered the monster's head off in the morgue? But there had been no time. Turl went low to the right, then to the left, then to the right. Rhythmical. Easy to predict. Johnny was in front of him every time. Too late, Johnny realized it was a trap. The fourth time, Turl's guns were firing at the place Johnny was about to be. Only the slip of a finger on a key saved him from being blasted out of the sky. Abruptly, Turl seemed to abandon his effort to get through to the compound. He headed straight north. Down below, the burning plane sent up soaring piles of black smoke. Was this another Turl trick, luring him off? Ears blasted by the scream of tortured motors, Johnny swept his eyes across the view screens. Where was Turl going, and why? With a sudden hunch, he flipped on a heat detection screen. Chrissy and Patty riding to the north, their horses' bellies to the ground as they raced along. Leverage. Johnny suddenly realized Turl was trying to get back his leverage. If he could recover his hostages, he might bring pressure on Johnny. Johnny flipped open the local command radio. Sure enough, Turl's voice.
If you don't go down there and land, animal, I'll kill them both.
Turl was right ahead of him, dropping down to about 4,000 feet. Johnny hit his keys. He estimated exactly where Turl would be. Johnny's battle plane slammed into the back of Turl's. Johnny closed the switch for the magnetic grips. The skids of his plane locked to the back of Turl's. Half deafened by the thud of contact, Johnny stepped up his speed control to hypersonic. His motors shrieked. He punched in coordinates to compare with 6 feet underground directly below them. He glanced over the side to see that the riders were clear of that spot. They were. The motors of both ships were screaming in discord, fighting against one another in howling dissonance. They jerked and wrestled in the sky, suspended in space. The motors began to get hot. Very shortly, they would burn and explode. Johnny reached for the jetpacks. The straps had already been shortened. He shrugged into it. He made sure he still had Turl's belt gun. He took one final glance at the keyboard, locked in. 6 feet underground, directly below, 4,000 feet down, speed control at hypersonic. Johnny dove out the plane door. The air bit at him as he plummeted down. His jets barked alive and the descent slowed. By swinging his legs, he went up to a higher altitude. He looked at the locked and fighting ships. He had expected that Turl would bail out. The outcome was inevitable. The ships would explode. He was counting on Turl's having no belt gun, and he intended to hunt him down in a jetpack or on the ground. But Turl didn't bail out. Johnny could see him battering away at his control console. Johnny, holding in space with his backpack jets, had the sickening feeling he had made a mistake. Turl, after all, knew Cyclo tactics backward. What Turl was doing in that jerking, fighting mess where one ship's motors fought the other's was trying to outguess the settings of the plane that rode his back. If he could, both motors would agree. Possibly then, a quick roll and reversal of the settings would throw the other ship off his back. The smoke from those conflicting motors was already beginning to rise in the battle plane Johnny had bailed out of. Suddenly, Turl got the combination.